Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story Podcast, and we're talking about the world's biggest pop star, Taylor Swift, a musical and economic powerhouse. But could she really swing the US presidential election? It's a matter of furious debate in Republican circles. Are they onto something? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 9th of February, these are our main stories. The US warns Israel against going ahead with its military offensive into the southern Gazan city of Rafah.
We would not support the undertaking of something like this without serious and credible planning.
Ukraine's top general, Valery Zaluzhny, gets the sack.
Today I have decided to renew the leadership of the armed forces of Ukraine.
And a police investigation into whether there was a coup attempt after Brazil's last election gets ever closer to former President Bolsonaro. Also in this podcast, the UN warns of a deepening crisis in Mongolia where extreme weather has devastated livestock herds. And
it's one of those songs where everyone who was alive and around in the 1980s immediately goes back to where they were in 1988. But kids love it too.
Why Fast Car by Tracy Chapman is making a comeback. For much of the past 4 months, the US has been urging Israel to avoid civilian deaths in Gaza. But now the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has said he has ordered the Israeli army to move into the southern city of Rafah, where there are 1.5 million people. The US State Department spokesman, Vedant Patel, said this would be a disaster.
We would not support the undertaking of something like this without serious and credible planning as it relates to the more than 1 million people who are sheltering there, as well as without considering the impacts on humanitarian assistance and the safe departure of foreign nationals.
I asked our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman how rare an intervention this is for the U.S.
It's very unusual. Whenever the State Department or the National Security Council spokesman are asked about what Israel may be planning to do in Gaza, the usual reply is, well, we don't speculate on things. That's for the Israelis to be asked, or they're not going to sort of telegraph Israel's military actions. So what we had here was very pointedly, at the same time, the deputy spokesman at the State Department, the spokesman at the National Security Council at the White House, talking about the fact that any unplanned operation of this kind would be, in their words, a disaster. And the key point they're making is that there are the best part of 1.5 million people in Rafah, many of them simply living in tents or in the open air. It's the middle of winter. The conditions have been absolutely diabolical. And so for there to be a major military assault in those conditions where there'd been sort of no effort to evacuate anyone would clearly be disastrous. Benjamin Netanyahu said that if this happened, it would be within the bounds of international law and there would be an evacuation.
The US can issue a warning, but will Israel pay any attention?
I mean, that's a very good question. And I think the fact they're saying it publicly is a sign, really, of the sort of growing irritation and frustration that Antony Blinken has about some of the things he's been trying to get the Israelis to do not being heeded. So that may be an example of what we've seen in the past, is things not being listened to. During his trip to the Middle East over the last week, there was sort of increasingly the sense or an accusation that he wasn't able to get to use leverage with the Israelis and not able to get some of the things delivered on that the US wants. Now, what the US always says is, you know, they have got more aid into Gaza. That's a result of US initiative, pressure on the Israelis. That has had an effect. But clearly on that much bigger picture of this, just the catastrophic scale of civilian deaths in Gaza, the fact remains the message isn't getting through.
Tom Bateman. Donald Trump is facing numerous legal cases in the months leading up to the US presidential election. But the most important one is probably his attempt to stop states banning him from the ballot on the allegation that he engaged in insurrection when his supporters stormed the US Capitol to stop Joe Biden being sworn in. His lawyers have been arguing in front of the Supreme Court to keep him on the ballot. Here's one of the justices, Ketanji Brown Jackson, questioning Mr. Trump's lawyer, Jonathan Mitchell.
For an insurrection, there needs to be an organized, concerted effort to overthrow the government of the United States through violence.
And so the point is that a chaotic effort to overthrow the government is not an insurrection?
No, we didn't concede that it's an effort to overthrow the government either, Justice Jackson. Right? None of these criteria were met. This was a riot. It was not an insurrection.
Our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, told me more about the hearing.
The more testy parts were directed towards the counsel for the state of Colorado. And interestingly, even some of the more liberal justices seem very sceptical about their case, particularly this idea that somehow Donald Trump, president, is one of those cases where, you know, insurrection should be used as a disqualifying factor, even though the constitutional clause at stake doesn't mention the president, which is a bit of a problem for Colorado. But also in questioning whether Colorado jumped the gun a bit and whether they had the right to determine what should happen effectively across the country, because while Colorado is saying, we just want to do this in our place, they know if this gets confirmed by the Supreme Court, it would disqualify effectively Donald Trump everywhere.
But does this mean that we're getting a sense of where this is going?
I think so. The justices go away now and think about it, and then there'll be, you know, decision of the court on a basis of a majority. And they will do that in pretty short order because the Republican primary is on March the 5th. And they will be all too aware that voters in that state need to know whether or not Donald Trump's name, which will be on the ballot, whether any votes for him will be counted. So if today is anything to go by, I'd be very surprised if they upheld Colorado's ban on Donald Trump.
Gary O'Donoghue. In Brazil, an investigation into whether the government of Jair Bolsonaro tried to plot a military takeover after losing the 2022 election is now targeting some of the former president's closest allies, including a former justice minister and high-ranking military officers. Federal police carried out dozens of searches and have arrested four people in the deepening investigation into the attempted coup on the 8th of January last year. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said the coup attempt wouldn't have happened without Mr. Bolsonaro.
He wasn't ready to win. He wasn't prepared to lose. He wasn't prepared to leave. So much so that he didn't even have the courage to say congratulations. He went home crying and travelled to the United States because he must have participated in this coup attempt.
Our South America correspondent Ione Wells has more details.
In January last year, supporters of Jair Bolsonaro stormed and vandalised the Congress, Supreme Court and parts of the presidential palace in Brasilia after he lost the election to his left-wing rival Lula da Silva and disputed the result. This investigation is considering whether Mr. Bolsonaro and his closest aides and ministers were responsible for inciting the attempted coup. In a statement, police said some of those under investigation were suspected of spreading claims of electoral fraud, even before the election took place, to legitimise a military intervention. The former president has been ordered to hand his passport over to the authorities. He's insisted he's the innocent victim of a politically motivated operation. This is just one of a number of investigations into Jair Bolsonaro and his allies. Others are looking into the former president's attacks on Brazil's election system and COVID vaccines, as well as foreign gifts he received. Mr. Bolsonaro has already been banned from running for office for 8 years over his attempts to undermine the voting system.
Ione Wells. After weeks of speculation, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has fired his top general as part of an effort to shake up the military. This was how he confirmed the dismissal of Commander-in-Chief Valery Zaluzhny.
Today we had a frank discussion about the changes needed in the army. I propose that General Zaluzhny continue to be part of the Ukrainian state team. I would be grateful for his consent. Today I have decided to renew the leadership of the armed forces of Ukraine.
He'll be replaced by General Oleksandr Syrsky. BBC Monitoring's Russia editor Vitaly Shevchenko told me about the significance of this announcement.
It's very serious. He is the face of Ukraine's relatively successful counteroffensive of 2022. almost universally revered by Ukrainians and respected by the Ukrainian military. And the discussion that I've seen after almost a year of near stagnation on the front line, the Ukrainian leadership is keen to reboot the military machine.
So who is General Sirsky?
General Sirsky, he's been fighting in Donbass in eastern Ukraine for about 10 years. He was appointed in charge of defending Kyiv right at the start of the Russian invasion almost 2 years ago. Then he masterminded Ukraine's surprisingly fast and effective counteroffensive in northeastern Kharkiv region, defended Bakhmut. So President Zelensky's hope would be that he would reinvigorate Ukraine's efforts to fight the Russians back. This was never going to be a popular decision, frankly, and I've had a look at comments on President Zelensky's social media, and the most popular comments are rude, and people are saying General Zaluzhny should be the last person to be sacked.
I mean, this sends a fairly strong message to Russia, too, not necessarily a message they want to send.
Russia is definitely happy to see what's going on in Ukraine, and the closest we came to getting an explanation of why exactly this is happening, it came from a senior presidential advisor, Mykhailo Podolyak, who said a new strategy needs to be developed, new high-tech solutions need to be implemented. So it's not just about General Zaluzhny.
Vitaly Shevchenko. An international conservation organization, Space for Giants, has erected 500 electric fences in Gabon to deter elephants from trampling on crops. So far, nearly 5,000 subsistence farmers have benefited from the mobile fences, which also help protect the endangered African forest elephant. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, compiled this report.
The African forest elephant is the smaller of the continent's two species, just over 2 metres tall, but it can cause huge destruction to crops and livelihoods. Villagers would often be woken up in the middle of the night by the sound of the animals and then rush out to bang pots and pans to try to scare them away. But now they can sleep soundly, as the fences have been proven to be the most effective deterrent, with a success rate of 95%. Eric Shahosky is the country director for Space for Giants. He told me about the scale of the problem.
Gabonese live in very small villages, generally less than 100 people in a village. The elephants are all over the country. This is a national crisis. Most Gabonese farmers plant for subsistence reasons. And elephants, they can have this impact where you have a year's worth of work that's devastated in a single evening.
Gabon has around 95,000 forest elephants, the largest population of the species in the world. Space for Giants is working with the Ministry of Water and Forests to install more of these barriers. They're not obtrusive, just a single electric wire about a metre above the ground attached to two posts or even trees, and they emit a non-fatal electric shock to the elephant. They also protect the species because farmers don't need to kill the creatures to stop them destroying their plants.
Richard Hamilton. The director Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon, is based on a true story exploring the systematic murder of the Oklahoma Osage Indians in the 1920s by white businessmen intent on swiping the native oil rights for themselves. At the heart of the film is a love story between an Osage woman, played by Lily Gladstone, and her white husband, Leonardo DiCaprio. He is convinced to poison her by his threatening uncle, played by Robert De Niro, the brains behind a series of murders aimed at acquiring land and money from the wealthy Osage. Scorsese makes a cameo appearance at the end with the poignant line, "There was no mention of the murders." Amol Rajan asked him whether the film was his attempt to right that historical wrong.
I think so. I didn't think of it that way. I just became immersed in the subject matter. Really what got me was that when the Bureau of Investigation went into the Osage County, they went in, they tried to look for the perpetrators. They basically said, who did it? And as I was reading the book, and as Eric Roth and I were working on the script, I began to realize who didn't do it. And I became more fascinated with the complicity of everyone involved, the community itself. The community, hence the state, hence the country. Telling the story through the love story between Molly and Ernest, out of that came the realization that this is something that was completely covered. And nobody spoke about it. At first, we were dealing with the script from the Bureau of Investigation's point of view.
So the film's much more of a love story now.
Well, it became a love story because Margie Burcott got up and she spoke. And she's the granddaughter of Molly and Ernest. And she pointed out that it's not simply perpetrator and victim. He said, Molly and Ernest were in love. And when I heard that, I said, that might be the story. And that's eventually what Leo and I felt. And he said, let me play Ernest instead. And so we went from the love story out. And as far as how I was affected by it, I kind of lived with them. I lived in another world. Something that I would have perceived as a downtown New Yorker, as something extremely foreign, became really friends. You know, began to know each other. When we all became friends, we all worked together and made the film.
You worked together for many, many years with Robert De Niro, for many, many years with Leo DiCaprio. But this is the first time in 30 years that they've been together in a film. Was that a long-held ambition to bring those two together?
That was always an ambition. It was not necessarily this film. It just turned out that way. Also, interestingly enough, for me and for Bob and for Leo, the relationship reflects also the mentor and the student, the father and the son.
What makes Bob De Niro one of the greats?
For me, he touches it's a tricky word, but a truth about what it is to be a human being and the acceptance of not only the good, but also the bad, maybe even the evil, to the extent where you may deplore his behavior as a character. You still feel for him? How is that?
Is there a bit of you in the character that Bobby De Niro has played?
I'm sure. I found that to deny it, it's a lie. And so if there is an element of it, let's explore it in myself if I can. And I was lucky enough in these films.
Let me, in only a spirit of fairness, ask you about Leo DiCaprio. What makes Leo DiCaprio one of the greats?
First of all, and this is from somebody studying the footage as we edit it, myself and Thelma, you could see this guy has a natural face for cinema. He doesn't have to do anything. You could feel by frame looking in certain takes and choosing takes, and you could see his eyes move a certain way. Doesn't have to say anything. He's a natural.
Martin Scorsese speaking to Amal Rajan. Still to come in the Global News podcast, the not-quite-so-chic part of Paris that's gearing up for the Summer Olympics.
People think there is more insecurity here because there are more foreigners.
Are you going to give a good welcome to the thousands of visitors who are going to come here?
Of course. Don't you feel safe now? Inshallah, you'll be safe with us, brother.
Iraq says repeated U.S. strikes against Iranian-backed militias on its soil are threatening the region's stability. The Iraqi government says it might be forced to end the presence of American troops in Iraq, who are helping to prevent a resurgence of the Islamic State group. On Wednesday, a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad killed a senior commander of a powerful pro-Iranian group. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, attended his funeral in the city on Thursday and sent this report.
With chants of no, no to America, mourners gathered in Baghdad to bury the militia leader, Abu Bakr al-Sa'adi. He was a commander of Kataib Hezbollah, blamed by the US for killing three of its troops in Jordan. Last night, America tracked him down with a missile. As his coffin was carried shoulder high through the crowds, there were promises of retaliation. Here's Faisal al-Sa'adi, a Shia cleric.
This evil attack will be met with the response from our brothers in the resistance. There is no negotiation with the Americans, and there is no solution except to knock down their bases.
Baghdad has angrily condemned the US strike. It was a clear-cut assassination in a residential neighborhood, said a spokesman for Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, Iraq's prime minister. He said America was violating Iraqi sovereignty, risking Iraqi lives, and increasing instability. That's a stunning indictment of an ally. Every American attack fuels more anger here. The United Nations envoy in Iraq says the country, like the wider Middle East, is on a knife edge.
Orla Guerin in Baghdad. Extreme weather events across the world are all too common, and in Mongolia, a natural disaster called a dzud has caused a humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. Celia Hatton, our Asia-Pacific editor, has been following the story and began by telling me just what a dzud is.
Well, a dzud is a weather event that's specific to Mongolia, and it's almost like a twin set of disasters. A large percentage of the population of Mongolia, around 40%, are herders. They move with their livestock throughout the year. They allow the livestock to graze on Mongolia's abundant grasslands. The first part of the dzud takes place during the summer. And that's when there's some kind of weather event, heavy rain or drought, that might affect the grasslands to be able to grow in abundance during the summer, because that's when livestock usually are allowed to feed and get fat. That's when herders will gather hay, gather food to store away for the winter. Now, this past summer, I should say, started off quite well, but then there was a really cold snap and there was a drought. And so a lot of the grass died off. And so that means the cattle were quite weak to begin with, and the animals, goats, horses, sheep, and then also the herders weren't able to gather food to put away for the winter. Now, the winter is the second part of the twin disaster. It's been a horrific winter. There's been extreme cold, minus 40 degrees Celsius, very thick snow and thick ice. Animals can't even get through the ice to be able to graze on anything that might still be there. And because the livestock are dying off, herding families are not able to support themselves. So it's a real humanitarian disaster now.
Why is this only happening in Mongolia?
That's because Mongolia has a really specific climate. It has the grasslands that I've mentioned, but because it's so close to Russia and Siberia, it has Siberian winds that come down and push into the grassland. And so that's why it has these beautiful summers, green grasslands, and then really harsh, cold winters. Researchers say they think the dzuds, now they're happening more and more often, and the grasslands simply aren't able to recover, and that means the animals aren't able to recover. They're not having as many babies. Lots of Mongolian herders are trying to save the babies. They're bringing them into their yurts and cuddling them, trying to keep them warm so they don't freeze to death the way that some of the older, bigger animals are.
Celia Hatton. Paris is hosting the Olympic Games later this year, but most of the action will be to the east of the city in Seine-Saint-Denis, where the Olympic Village has been built and where the national stadium, the Stade de France, is situated. Seine-Saint-Denis is one of the highest immigrant origin populations in France and is often associated with urban problems, drugs, crimes and riots in particular. But as John Lawrenson reports, this poor, populous part of France is hoping the Olympics will turn its reputation around.
Emerging from the metro in Saint-Denis is not very reassuring, mainly because of the number of guys hanging around who really don't look like they're waiting for their girlfriends. But more than a bit of the unease is due to what me and most of the other 68 million people who live in France carry around in our heads about the banlieue or suburbs in general, and this one in particular, possibly involving images of burning cars and crack dealers in hoodies. So much so that the idea of an agency for the development of tourism in Seine-Saint-Denis would strike many as some sort of joke, and yet it exists, and its director, Olivier Meyer, is waiting for me just a couple of hundred metres away. The Seine-Saint-Denis Cathedral Basilica is one of the first Gothic cathedrals, and the remains of the kings and queens of France are here.
Last year we had 100,000 visitors. That's nothing compared to the over 12 million a year who visited Notre-Dame de Paris before the fire. Here, we're a few minutes by metro from Paris, 10 minutes by foot from the Stade de France, 15 minutes from the Olympic Village. So we hope that, at last, the Cathedral Basilica will start to get the number of visitors it deserves.
One of the main reasons few visitors come now, he says, is Seine-Saint-Denis' image. But in fact, the last available figures show crime rates are as high in the centre of Paris as they are here. At the local market, most people say the reality is not so bad, and they hope to prove it during the Olympics.
People shouldn't worry. Saint-Saint-Denis is like everywhere else in France. There is good and bad.
I've been living here since 1958 and nobody's ever shown me a lack of respect.
Whenever I tell a colleague that I live in Seine-Saint-Denis, the way they see me changes. Sometimes when I find a girlfriend on Tinder, as soon as I say I live in Seine-Saint-Denis, she blocks me.
So are they right, these people, or are they wrong?
For me, they are a bit right, because there is a lot of violence here.
People think there is more insecurity here, because there are more foreigners, but it's the same everywhere. On the contrary, we foreigners are very welcoming.
Are you going to give a good welcome to the thousands of visitors who are going to come here?
Of course. Don't you feel safe now? A very warm welcome to you. Inshallah, you'll be safe with us, brother.
Inshallah, vous êtes en sécurité, la preuve.
Opinion polls say Parisians are a bit iffy about the Olympics. Paris is expecting a record 15 to 16 million visitors this summer. The transport system is already critically overcrowded, so people are legitimately concerned about overload. But those polls show a big difference in Seine-Saint-Denis, where 80% of people are enthusiastic. It's partly about money. A French parliamentary report concluded the Games will bring between 5 and 10 billion euros of revenue. One major subject of cafe conversation at the moment is who's going to try to make a fast euro by renting out a room for the Olympics, with Airbnb quoting prices 4, 5, 6 times higher than usual.
John Lawrenson. In a recent edition of the Global News podcast, we told you about a wonderful photo that's just won a prize. It's of a young polar bear asleep on a small iceberg drifting off the Norwegian Svalbard archipelago. The image won the People's Choice Award in the Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition run by Britain's Natural History Museum. It was taken by Nimi Sarikhani while on a 2-week trip with 7 other photographers during the COVID pandemic and in difficult conditions. He spoke to Tim Franks.
But the first 3 days was just incredibly foggy. You could barely see your outstretched hand. But luckily, after 3 days, the skies cleared up. In the drift ice, we came across this lovely bear.
It's a young bear. It looks enormously comfy on its bed of ice. It's at an angle of about 45 degrees. Am I right in saying that you witnessed it scooping out a sort of hollow in order to make its bed on the iceberg a bit more comfy?
That's correct. And you're right, it was a young bear. At one point, an older male came and tried to chase him off, but then the old bear lost interest and the young bear stayed around us, which was just magical. After about 3-4 hours of observing from the icebreaker, they lowered a couple of Zodiacs, rubber motorized boats, down, and we climbed on them and then spent another 4 hours with him. So he was just swimming through the pack ice, which is where they hunt for seals mostly. That photo was taken shortly before midnight, so obviously he got a bit knackered, wanted a nap, climbed aboard the small iceberg. He did claw out a shelf and had a short nap.
It looks blissful in its own savage way, I mean, because it is a savage landscape, but I wonder how far you think it fits into our concern about the changing climate. But, you know, the polar bears seem particularly exposed. Can we read anything into that from your image?
I believe so. This was my second trip. The previous one was 12, 13 years ago. There was far less ice this time than there was previously. And they acquire the drift ice to hunt predominantly for the main source of food, which is seals. They're strong swimmers and they can travel vast distances, but you don't want to place extra stress on them. They're also fairly adaptable. As I observed last year, actually, a couple of failed polar bear hunting reindeers. But it's not their natural food. They don't have the same amount of blubber, which is what they predominantly sustain themselves on. And they can overheat quite quickly while running on land. I think it does demonstrate the perils they face.
When you took this one image, did you know at the time that you had something really special?
Coming across the bear is elation. You get so excited on the day, and there's so many photos taken, took many thousands of images, and you always think you have one or two special ones. But I always like to sort of wait a few weeks and then revisit everything, because emotion can cloud which ones you really like. At that time, I thought it was unique. I hadn't ever seen a photo like that before, but it was just one of several. It was only when I went back and I realized what special moment it was that was the one that really captured my heart.
Photographer Nimi Sarikhani talking to Tim Franks. Now to a comeback that's been decades in the making.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal.
The song Fast Car gained the US singer Tracy Chapman legions of new fans after her performance of it with the country singer Luke Combs at Sunday's Grammy Awards. Her last appearance there was back in 1988 when she'd just released Fast Car and won Best New Artist for songs like Talking About a Revolution and Baby Can I Hold You. For a musician, Chapman has remained largely absent from the music world. Maybe that's why her appearance was described as a big highlight of the Grammys by many music critics, among them Chris Woolman from Variety, who spoke to Davina Gupta.
Tracy Chapman has been pretty much invisible for the last 15 years, except for three television appearances. Otherwise, no one's heard from her since 2009. No albums, no concerts, no tours. You know, apparently living very happily off the grid. People have talked about sightings of her in San Francisco at pet food stores. But I don't think people realized she was missing for a long time until this country hit came up with this cover of Fast Car by Luke Combs.
Seems pretty counterintuitive to the celebrity culture one is used to. Just last night, and I must admit, it was the first time I was listening to the song. I've grown up in India. For many people like me, just tell us what makes Tracy Chapman Tracy Chapman.
You know, she was always an anomaly. Even at her peak, the days when she was the biggest star, she was very reserved. She would say that she was shy. And for some reason, despite basically being a folk singer who was not, you know, super emotionally expressive or anything as a performer, she just drew people in. And it was largely the power of the songwriting. And in the case of Fast Car, I'm going to give some credit to that guitar lick too. But it's also the art of the storytelling. It's, you know, a narrative about people who have lost their dreams. They've had some economic distress. People relate to it, even though they don't necessarily think of it as depressing a song as you could read it. It's one of those songs where everyone who was alive and around in the 1980s immediately goes back to where they were in 1988, and maybe they heard it on Live Aid. But kids love it too, which is fascinating to me, as that's something I would not have guessed, but it has that power across generations.
And timeless as well. But for Tracy Chapman to get that kind of success at the age of 24, do you think it was too much pressure for her?
She indicated that she didn't deal well with the pressure. She hasn't done interviews to say what caused her to get out of the business. Her last album was in 2008. It peaked at number 57, so she wasn't having hits at the time. And maybe she just thought, I don't enjoy doing this. I'm not inherently someone who enjoys being out on stage, who likes doing interviews, so why do I need to bother anymore? And sometimes people who are recluses, we become even more fascinated with them. It's funny that Tracy Chapman and Taylor Swift talk about two opposites. I mean, Taylor Swift is endlessly feeding her audience with new product and constant information. Tracy has literally not been feeding her audience anything for the last 15 years. And yet right now, they're equally transfixing to a massive audience. It's almost hilariously ironic.
Do you feel that there could be something that her fans haven't heard?
Absence has really made the heart grow fonder. And right now, I think she could fill arenas. The world could be her oyster right now if she wanted it. It seems like she doesn't want it.
Before we let you go, Chris, do you drive a fast car?
No, I have a Honda. I had a turbocharged car once upon a time. Those were nostalgic days, just like in the song. Leave tonight, live and die this way.
Chris Woolman on the enduring popularity of Tracy Chapman, whose single Fast Car rose to the top of the iTunes charts after her performance at the Grammys on Sunday. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story Podcast, and we're talking about the world's biggest pop star, Taylor Swift, a musical and economic powerhouse. But could she really swing the US presidential election? It's a matter of furious debate in Republican circles. Are they onto something? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.